Gordon White, and I'm here for Superintendent Cicely Muldoon, who was called unexpectedly to Yosemite on assignment. I lead the Integrated Resource Management Program in the park, and I will be guiding the ceremony today. So thank you for coming all the way out here. I recognize that it's quite a schlep, but I suspect that you'll agree with me that it's worth it to be out here. We are here today to unveil the plaque designating the Drake's Bay Historic and Archaeological District National Historic Landmark. It's quite a mouthful, I know. We are also here to begin a thoughtful, lifelong conversation that I hope will allow us to learn from this history. To begin our ceremony today, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to Joanne Campbell, tribal elder from the Federated Indians of Great Rancheria, who will lead us in a blessing.
Makwantoishma Aniko Ununi Micha Mamolish Opo Shuki Bukam Keneto Wayamakontoish Ushki Punak Puna Makontoish Hinak Shukweato Shutami Makoni O.
So introductions are in order. Joining me here are three distinguished scholars and leaders who will speak to you. To my right is Greg Saris, tribal chairman of the Federated Indians of Great Rancheria. Edward Vonderporten, who is the president of the Drake Navigators Guild. And Marco Menichetti, professor and senior archaeologist at San Jose State University. Also with us is Lisa Cross, aide to Supervisor Steve Kinsey, and Elaine Rotondo Jackson, who is the National Historic Landmark Program Lead for the Western Region of the National Park Service. I'd also like to acknowledge Matt Russell, whose research also contributed to this national landmark. So I suspect you might wonder, what is a National Historic Landmark? A National Historic Landmark, or NHL as we often refer to them, is a nationally significant historic place designated by the Secretary of the Interior because it possesses exceptional value in interpreting the heritage of the United States. The historic themes represented by national landmarks are quite varied, from World War II and the American home front to astronomy and astrophysics, from American labor history to recreation in the United States. A National Historic Landmark is a special place where we can experience a turning point or significant event in American history. Just over 2,500 of these special places bear this distinction across the country. Marin County is graced with three other national landmark sites: the United States Immigration Station at Angel Island, the Marin County Civic Center, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, and the Point Reyes Life-Saving Station, just across the bay behind me. All of these national landmarks are places to reflect and to learn. It's a little windy up here. This national landmark encompasses the area where two significant historic events occurred and the Coast Miwok cultural sites that were directly influenced by these two events. As you will hear, this NHL honors the arrival here of Francis Drake in 1579, Sebastio Rodriguez Sarmiento in 1595, and the Coast Miwok people who lived here all along and met the explorers. Like many national landmarks, there is a tension between a deeply engaging history and the massive, difficult implications of that history. This week, I've reflected again on the importance of these events and the responsibilities that come with a national landmark designation. For me, it is a personal and professional responsibility to ensure that this history is told accurately and completely. For the National Park Service, in the year of its centennial, it is a familiar responsibility to preserve a place for conversation, for civil dialogue, and for understanding. For all of us, this place holds opportunity, an invitation to understand the lessons of this important history and apply them humanely to the increasingly complex issues we face. We do this not for just for ourselves, but for our children and grandchildren. They are watching us, learning from us, as we learn from our ancestors. So we come together in establishing this National Historic Landmark, not to celebrate history, but to honor history, to learn from history. I'd like to focus just briefly on how this district was designated a landmark. Less than 20% of National Historic Landmarks are federally owned. So most NHLs are the product of a collaboration of citizens and National Park Service staff who guide the nomination process of new landmarks. Even in this context of collaboration, the genesis of this designation is unusual. It lies in the work of the Drake Navigators Guild, a group of researchers who have worked tirelessly since 1949 to determine where Drake landed and to understand this early history. The Guild proposed and wrote early versions of the landmark nomination, and together with tribal contributions and National Park Service specialists, broadened the nomination to a narrative encompassing the first interactions between the Coast Miwok people and English and Spanish explorers. The nomination was presented to the National Parks Advisory Board in Washington, D.C. in 2011 and in Florida in 2012. Secretary of Interior Ken Salazar's signature established the Drake's Bay Historic and Archaeological District National Historic Landmark on October 16, 2012. The Guild had been working on this project for 63 years. It's a remarkable story of dedication and perseverance. Please welcome our first speaker, Ed Vonderporten, President of the Drake Navigators.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me well in the back there? Are we all right? Thank you. This commemoration has been a long time coming. Millennia have passed since the ancestors of our Coast Miwok people arrived on this site, settled, and created their unique culture. 451 years ago, Spaniards completed the dream of Columbus to connect the peoples of the world in peaceful commerce by way of the great oceans, by creating the Manila Galleon route that is marked on our shores by the wreck of the San Agustin and the encampment of her crewmen here in 1595. 437 years ago, Francis Drake and his crewmen landed here, met peacefully and respectfully with the Native Americans, made the first English claim to the land that would, in time, become the United States of America, named the land Nova Albion, a name which, as New England, would mark permanent English settlements on the other side of the continent, and held the first church service from the Anglican Book of Common Prayer in this land. 67 years ago, the Drake Navigators Guild was formed to seek the traces of the English and Spanish contacts with our shores, to learn about their relationships with the native peoples, and to tell those stories to all the peoples who now inhabit this land. 4 years ago, Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar signed the document creating the Drake's Bay Historic and Archaeological District National Historic Landmark to commemorate these three themes. The Drake Navigators Guild, which wrote the nomination for this landmark and shepherded it to fruition, has been fortunate in its leaders and colleagues, only a few of whom can be mentioned here today. Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, who inspired and guided us in our early years. Captain Adolf Oko, a hero of the Israeli War of Independence, who organized the Guild. Captain Raymond Aker, whose work with many nautical disciplines developed much of the evidence for the Drake Landing. Matthew P. Dillingham, who rediscovered Drake's Cove in 1952. Robert Allen and Robert Parkinson, who followed the natural history evidence in the Drake accounts. British Admiral Sir Simon Castles, who explained the navigation of the Golden Hind's voyage. The Asian Art Museum's Clarence Shangra, who identified Chinese porcelains left here by Francis Drake. And William Duddleson, who, working with for Congressman Clem Miller, wrote the legislation which created the Point Reyes National Seashore. All these and many, many more freely contributed time and talents without certainty of success or hope of reward. Many are no longer with us. Some live to see and hold the plaque which you will see unveiled here today, but are now gone. A few are among you today. Where are you? You may wonder, why did so many persons devote so much time and energy to this study of our past of 4.5 centuries ago? British scholar Geoffrey Bibby spoke for historians who search old manuscripts and for archaeologists who sift the sands. We work in pity and humility that the dead may live again, that what is past may not be forever lost, that something may be salvaged from the rack of the ages, that the past may color the present and give heart to the future. Our efforts are the only payment that we can make against the debt that we all owe to those who, through the millennia, fashioned the world in which we live. However, it is not only the recovery of the past that matters, but the bringing to new generations of our peoples better understandings of the aspirations, struggles, achievements, frequent failures, accumulated knowledge, and sometimes wisdom of the peoples of the past as guides toward, we trust, a more enlightened future. No institution is better suited for this role than the century-old National Park Service through its half-century-old National Historic Landmarks Program. We come here today to commemorate three great strands in our common heritage: the Native American, the English, and the Spanish. But they do not exist in isolation. Into these three strands are woven stories of Portuguese adventurers, such as Captain Sebastian Rodriguez Cermeño, or, we should say, Sebastião Rodriguez Soromeno of the San Agustin, of black men and women who in varied roles in Drake's and Soromeno's ships, of Mexican, Filipino, and Chinese voyagers in the Manila ships, and of all the peoples who contributed to the societies which created the ships and their cargoes and sent them on their voyages. Today, I speak of one of these three main strands, the greatest voyage of all time, Francis Drake's voyage around the world from 1577 through 1580, which is commemorated here for his landing in Nova Albion, a site visible from this podium, just to the right of the nearest white cliff. There is Nova Albion. Drake's astonishing life is a saga in itself. He rose from childhood poverty, living with his parents and 11 siblings and an abandoned hulk. At 12, he began his apprenticeship at sea, which was followed by participation in trading voyages to Africa and the New World, led by his cousin John Hawkins. Voyages that tested whether Englishmen would be permitted to enter the newly opened New World markets. The answer came in the treacherous attack on Hawkins' fleet at San Juan de Lua, Mexico, which Drake escaped by the narrowest of margins. That debacle led to Drake's taking part in the developing hot, cold war on behalf of his Queen Elizabeth by privateering in the Caribbean, where he captured a treasure-laden mule train in the jungles of Panama with the aid of a colony of escaped slaves. Then came the world voyage, one event of which we commemorate here today. Francis Drake went on to become Vice Admiral of England in an open war attack on the West Indies, in the burning of the Spanish invasion fleet at Cadiz, in the Armada battles of 1588, again in attacks on Spain, and once more in the West Indies and Panama, where he met his death from jungle fever a few miles away from where he first made his mark on history. There's Drake the person, daring, brash, energetic, self-promoting, decisive, violent only as seemed necessary in his times, yet caring of his crews and of his captives. His great Pacific raid saw not one loss of a Spanish life. Drake's nearly three-year-long voyage around the world is a great story within Drake's story. It was the first sailing of Englishmen south of the equator, followed by passage of the Straits of Magellan, dispersal of his ships by great storms, and discovery of Cape Horn and the Drake Passage south of Tierra del Fuego. Drake sailed north along the west coast of South and Central America, raiding Spanish treasure ports and ships, culminating in his capture of a treasure ship from Peru, carrying 26 tons of silver, valued at half of his queen's annual revenues. Then he sailed far out to sea and searched far to the north, and then to the northeast, as far as the southern coast of Oregon, for the elusive Northwest Passage. Finding a forbidding coastline rather than a strait, he turned and sailed 300 miles down the California coast. Coming from the north, he saw a great granite headland, which you can see behind me. Rounded it, ran 3 miles along Point Reyes Head, and found a great bay opening up beyond the bay which we look upon today. In your mind's eye, can you see a tiny square-rigged sailing ship clearing Chimney Rock, followed by the slightly larger Golden Hind? A turn of rudders and adjustment of sails, and Drake sailed into this bay and toward the entrance of the Estero. The entrance, again, you can barely see back here to the right of the white cliff. Here in the cove, visible from this spot, he found a haven sheltered by the great white cliffs. Drake remained here in Portus Nova Albionis for 36 days, repairing and resupplying his ship and establishing friendly relations with the Coast Miwok peoples. On his way into the Pacific, he visited the Farallon Islands, which, on a good day, are also visible from this site. Survived a grounding in the West Indies and completed a circumnavigation by way of the Spice Islands, the Cape of Good Hope, and the Bulge of Africa, at one point sailing 9,700 miles without touching land. But it is the context, the wider story, that makes this commemoration so significant. It is the story of the wrenching changes from the inward-looking medieval European worldview through the exhilarating expansion of intellectual as well as geographical knowledge of the age of exploration, to the complex decisions by many persons high and low in Queen Elizabeth's day, which defined so many of the interlinked political, economic, social, and religious issues we live with today, which provide the context to Drake's landing in California, and make the dedication of this marker, which encompasses in so few words so many aspects of this history, so meaningful to our peoples. Drake's life was shaped by and helped shape many of these larger concerns. Prominent among them were the choices between a unitary political and religious world and one in which varied societies and creeds would struggle to work out accommodations with each other and vie for leadership by the persuasiveness of their visions for the world's peoples. In Drake's day, these choices often were disputed by violence rather than debate. The struggle for freedom of the seas in the bloodied waters of San Juan de Lu in 1568. The desperate struggle for self-determination when England's allies, the people of the Netherlands, cut the great dike at Rotterdam in 1574, flooded half the province of Holland, saved the besieged city of Leiden, created a great university, and established their independent republic. The defiance of the dominant world power in 1588 when the English seamen drummed the Armada up the channel into the North Sea in oblivion. Later, but linked to their Elizabethan predecessors, would come the political changes embodied in the English Glorious Revolution, the American Declaration of Independence, Constitution, and Bill of Rights, and the French Revolution, and later still, the social changes of labor, minorities, women, gays, in our own lifetimes and in the city that is, weather permitting, within view of this gathering, San Francisco. Our generation would see the creation of the United Nations as a new effort to establish a better way of ordering our world for the benefit of all. But those are stories for other days and other national landmarks. So today we commemorate the landing of Francis Drake, who here in Nova Albion helped set our ancestors and all of us on new, untried, and infinitely complex paths on June 17th, 1579. Join us in passing this story on to future generations.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Marco Menichetti, professor and senior archaeologist at San Jose State University. He serves on the executive board of the Advisory Council for Underwater Archaeology and was co-founder of the San Augustine Institute for Nautical Archaeology in 1985 and Institute for Interdisciplinary Caribbean Studies in 2005. Dr. Menichetti is also focused on contact period studies and the dynamics of early pre-industrial globalization. We welcome Dr. Marco Menichetti.
Thank you for that introduction. Friends of historical preservation and research, distinguished guests, scouts, a few years beyond 400 years ago, on a day I think very much like this day, an event of singular significance occurred in the waters off Point Reyes, influencing the history of California and the native peoples of this region. The Mininic galleon, San Augustine, was wrecked, the captain and crew suddenly marooned, and for a second time in a scant 16 years, Europeans and the Coast Miwok came into direct contact here on the edge of the world. Ironically, the ship and crew were engaged in exploration to find a safe and secure harbor along California's unknown and intensely treacherous coast. The wrecking episode also meant that again the entrance to the San Francisco Bay was bypassed, and the outcome of the voyage persuaded navigators to shy away from the coast for more than a century, undoubtedly to the benefit of regional societies. The wreck interests nautical archaeologists because of the rare type of ship that a Manila galleon is, of which little is known, and anthropologists because of the implications and the nature of cross-cultural contacts that ensued. The principal document used by all investigators is the Relación of Sebastián Rodríguez Cermeño, which is held in the archives of Seville in Spain, dated to 1596. Cermeño was captain of the ship, but the loss of the ship is mentioned in the relation only in a single time and in a nondescript and unenlightening manner. What has long eluded scholars are the precise details surrounding the wrecking episode and the contact which occurred. Descriptions of the interactions between the crew and local inhabitants, which are of particular interest, are also vague. There are, however, other cartas alluding to separate testimony, as well as comments in letters by explorer Sebastian Vizcaino, who sought to recover the ship's cargo in 1602. This matters because within living memory of people who called this place home, strangers with unusual dress, customs, and language were again on the coast, perhaps three times within the living memory of some members of the local population. There's archaeological evidence that cargo entered the material culture of local populations, likely impacting social relations. Spain's effort to expand its empire to the Far East and to capitalize on the riches of the spice trade were the impetus behind astonishing sea voyages from South America and Mexico across the Pacific to the Philippines. The earliest voyages from Mexico to reach the Philippines were met with failure. In 1565, Francisco de Sacero and Andreas de Urdaneta successfully returned to Mexico, sailing in the northern latitudes from the Philippines. With this voyage, the Manila trade was born, and with it, a nascent globalization. With imperial hubris, Spain considered California part of its New World empire, but it was an unknown, Spain managed to establish a fledgling colony at Manila, well situated to become the preeminent entrepot of the region. From 1565 until 1815, Spain would maintain this commercial route linking the Philippines with Mexico. During that time, crews of Manila ships were mixed of nationalities, both European and Asian, with cultural influences traveling in each direction. The voyage of the Manila Galleons can be viewed as the initial phase of California, shifting from being perceived of as the edge of the world to the gateway to the world. That this navigation should continue for so long is all the more remarkable when we consider it as one of the longest and harshest routes ever navigated, often lasting 7 months or longer. It has been calculated that one of every 15 ships came to grief. Along the west coast, there are known to be at least 3 galleons wrecked, and possibly 4, including San Agustin. Merchant interests in Manila and their agents in Spain argued continuously for the Crown to sponsor voyages of exploration along California's coast to locate a safe harbor in which the Manila galleons could find refuge, take on fresh water, and restore their depleted foodstuffs. It was not concern for the crew, but worry over the loss of cargo that inspired this, and concern over economic growth. Sebastian Rodriguez Cermeño, a skilled Portuguese pilot, was appointed the task. The San Agustin was a small vessel of some 200 tons burthen. And San Agustin set sail in July 1595 in the company of 2 larger galleons, the Margarita and San Felipe. All 3 ships carried the usual cargo bound for Mexico: porcelain, spices, textiles, and other exotics. At the first signs of the California coast, following an uneventful crossing of the Pacific, San Agustin parted company with the other 2 ships. Cermeño piloted the San Agustin to within a few miles of Cape Mendocino at a latitude of 42 degrees, or slightly lower, and began charting the coast southward. On November 5th, 1595, he rounded Point Reyes and entered, in his words, a horseshoe-shaped bay, which he refers to as Bahia Grande, later naming it San Francisco, not the same San Francisco as we know today. According to Cermeño, native people immediately paddled out to the vessel on boats made of reeds and with some expectations. Cermeño's accounts of events leading to this position are clear enough to establish that he was indeed near Limantour Spit that juts out in front of Drake's Estero, and not under the shelter of the promontory that forms the point, as Viscaino indicates on his own map for 1602. However, he is absolutely mute on what happened next. It seems that Cermeño had intended to use this area as a base of operations to commence his explorations. But a freakish storm, a wind, came up, and the ship was inexplicably wrecked, or run aground, or, well, it depends on which document you read. What we know is that the ship was lost. The intention was to use a small plank boat, a kit boat, really, to explore the inlets and waterways. This boat now became their lifeline. At this point, the relations between the crew of the San Agustin and the coast Miwok became deeply strained. The survivors eventually reached Acapulco, Mexico, in this open plank boat, successfully charting the coast as they sailed, a frightful and epic journey in its own right. The Viscaino believed that it would be possible to salvage the ship is relevant to our interpretation of these events. His pilot, Francisco Bolaños, had been a crew member of the ill-fated San Agustin and had expected to find the vessel when they arrived here in 1602. The commemoration of this place is poignant and significant, in that it marks a location and a time in history of critical cross-cultural contact, and where the modern world began to take shape. A global economy was emerging, and interaction among diverse cultures across great distances was increasing with predictable consequences. A partnership between Spain and NOAA, recognizing the importance of this vessel in history, an agreement to protect the resource for future study by the National Park Service, is promising. And I would like to acknowledge the enthusiasm and continuing interest of the California Heritage Council for the commemoration of these important events. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. Our next speaker is Chairman Greg Saris, author, teacher, and tribal leader. Chairman Saris was born and raised in Santa Rosa, went to school at UCLA, where he received a degree in 1977, received two master's degrees and a PhD in modern thought and literature from Stanford. He's taught at UCLA and at Loyola Marymount. In 2005, Chairman Saris returned to his beloved Sonoma County, where he holds the Grayton Rancheria Endowed Chair in Writing and Native American Studies at Sonoma State. Chairman Saris is also a prolific writer. He's written several novels, collections of short stories and plays. He is currently serving his 12th term as chairman of the Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria. On behalf of his tribe, he co-authored the bill that restored Federated Coast Miwok as a recognized American Indian tribe, signed into law on December 27, 2000. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Chairman Greg Saris. Can everybody hear me all right? Okay, great. I have a pretty big voice, but the wind, I don't know if I can compete with the wind. Welcome, everybody, and what a interesting and opportunity for Indian people and non-Indian people and those of us who are both to be here today. There are many stories, and we heard stories and about where exactly Drake landed or what happened, and we have stories too about what happened. The great story that we often tell, it's been passed down, is that when we saw the ships coming, and it isn't just here but further up the coast near Fort Ross, many of the Indian tribes along the coast refer to the Europeans in various terms. One of them is the undersea people, because when we saw the ships coming, it looked like they were coming up out of the water from behind. Here specifically, the story in this area is that when we saw the first white people coming, and we saw the ships coming, and when we saw the pale faces, it just so happens that to the left of me away, on the other side of that point, traditionally has been a place where we say the dead step off to go follow the moon, the line of the moon, to the land of the dead when they die. So it's very interesting that when the white people, call him Drake, landed here, we thought the dead were returning. After all, they were pale-faced, they looked sickly, and then when they came ashore, they smelled horribly. Remember, the Europeans, they didn't bathe, because there's still a joke among us Indian people, and the term brave came, who could ever go closest to a European? When they came, this is just one of the stories. And we were confused. We went back up to our villages, spread the word, put ashes over our face, and met them in a funeral ceremony, a ceremony for the dead. Now, to what extent that actually happened or didn't happen or is passed down, I don't know. But what we do know, and what's very clear from both stories, even what you've heard today this morning, was that there was confusion and lack of understanding between people. And the confusions were, as it would turn out, were very deep. Much deep. People have often asked about the California Indians, people in this area, where we're sitting today and in Central California, there are more people here in the New World per capita than there was anywhere outside of the present site of Mexico City today, which was the Aztec capital. More people anywhere, speaking more languages. The only other place there was as many different languages, perhaps the Central Philippines. But here, every language family found in the New World is found in California. And ethnographers and anthropologists have always wondered, how did so many people living so close together live here peacefully, basically, for so long, for thousands and thousands of years? How did that happen? Well, many of the Europeans, in fact, many of the early Spanish, thought, of course, the California Indians were the dumbest of the all the folks. Again, the tendency for all of us is to see other cultures and other people in terms of our own cultural lens. So, of course, the Plains Indians were highly valued and thought to be the smartest. Why? Because they had what Europeans valued, organized warfare. And they gave a lot of trouble. So they thought, well, they're smart, they're organized, well, they're a problem.
Here, we had warfare. It was just more subtle. We poisoned you, and you dropped dead the next day. And again, Europeans had a tendency to have a hard time understanding subtlety. So let's go back. How did so many people live so close together for so long? It had to do with our story, essential story, and I'm generalizing, and that is that every aspect of the landscape in which we lived had power. A tiny stone had as much power as you did. You wouldn't know. I would have songs. I would have certain songs and things associated with me so that if you stole from me or hurt me, even if I didn't know it, my song, my spirit would protect you so that your mother would drop dead the next day. That's how it worked. You didn't mess. And what that taught us is everything in nature had incredible power so that if you disrespected it or didn't follow the rules, something would come back on you. Something would come back on you. And you were always reminded that you weren't the center of the universe, that you didn't own things. And if you started to think that way, you would be, in our term, poisoned. Voodoo. In fact, one of the terms, speaking of terms, for the Europeans that the Kashaya people had was miracles. And I used to ask the old people, why do you call white people miracles? And they said, well, when they came here, they were killing animals and killing people and chopping down trees. And instead of getting punished, more of them kept coming, and we thought they were miraculous. Well, as we know today, as we sit here today and look around, we know that nobody is a miracle because it's all come back on us. Every bit of water here is poisoned. The air, the grasses, the landscape, it's all coming back on us. Maybe one of the things we can do today is begin to use this marking spot, this place here, to create a dialogue once again where there's an ethic and aesthetic of place that's based on respect and equality and power in all things. That's, I think, one of the things that is going to happen. Let's talk about the European story, the confusion. They came from a long tradition. Let's just pick one of the stories. Hear the story about the people that were escaped slavery and were walking along the desert. What happened? They were promised a home, right? Two things happened. They were promised a home and they were told they were entitled and special. That was somewhat of a lethal combination. You're special and better than anybody, and you're promised a home that isn't your indigenous home. I understand it came out of a slavery, it came out of a long history. But that story kept getting told over and over. And everywhere that tradition, in whatever way it evolved, whether it was Christianity, the Muslim religion, or whatever, it kept evolving. I'm better, I'm best, a history of domination and work. And when those Spanish ships were coming around and coming from the Philippines, remember they were capturing slaves and using them for working all throughout the middle, all throughout Central America and in the Caribbean. They may have been looking for spice or whatever they were looking for, but they were also trading in human cargo and using people and indigenous people. And as a consequence, we had a caste system. Again, that long other story of domination and so forth. It's taken its consequences in my own people, Southern Pomo and Coast Miwok. At the time of contact, you can argue there are probably 10,000 of us from the Sausalito all the way up to the Santa Rosa Plain. Today, of the enrolled 1,300 members, all of us are descendants of 14 survivors. And again, it's nothing to feel all guilty or say what's wrong. The importance is if we don't start talking about how these histories live in us, and it is true that the Indians always believed, as we always believed, words are power and they're living in you. If you don't understand the way your stories are shaping your relationships with other people and with the land, and if you don't start talking about ways to modify those stories, we're probably not going to make it. But we can start here. We can start here today and use this point of contact to continue the story and create what did not happen in the past, which is a dialogue. That's what we need. A dialogue between peoples of difference. A dialogue that works toward respect and responsibility for each human life and for the landscape itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny.
So I'd like to ask Lisa Cross to come on up. Lisa is the aide to Supervisor Steve Kinsey, and she has a proclamation and a message from Steve and from, I guess, from the Congress.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd just like to express my appreciation to our speakers today for sharing these amazing stories, this amazing history, and also for reminding us that this event itself is historic and that it's a path to the future in which we interpret these stories and carry them forward in our own lives and share them also with all of the future visitors to this park. So I want to thank you all also for being here to celebrate. In particular, on behalf of Supervisor Kinsey and the Marin County Board of Supervisors, and on behalf of Congressman Jared Huffman, I'd like to thank all of the people who helped make this historic landmark designation happen. And in particular, I'd like to recognize the Drake Navigators Guild, the Federated Indians of the Great Rancheria, the National Park Service, and the National Historic Landmark Program for really decades of work to make this wonderful designation happen. And on behalf of Congressman Huffman, I'd like to present a beautiful certificate of appreciation, and if I may, I'll just read it. It's very brief. Certificate of special congressional recognition presented in honor of the Drake's Bay Historic and Archaeological District National Historic Landmark dedication. Presented on the occasion of the recognition of Drake's Bay as a National Historic Landmark, this important location, site of the earliest documented contact between Europeans and California Indians and the earliest recorded shipwreck on the West Coast, is an important piece of our United States history and is a part of what makes Marin County unique. Congratulations on this important and historic event, October 22, 2006, Congressman Jared Huffman. Thank you all for being here today.
So we'll now unveil the plaque over here, and I'd like to ask come with me over to the rock. Before we actually walk over there, this will be the end of the ceremony. I would like to invite you to a reception just after this. The reception is back at park headquarters, where it's not so windy, and there's some food and interesting material on tables and a chance to just socialize. Again, it's back at park headquarters. You just go back the way that you came and turn onto Bear Valley Road and go to the red barn there, and that's where the ceremony or the reception will be.